5. The Stuff of Myths and Legends. Task Force Piranha, 2003-2004. Until mid-2003, ordinary Melburnians sized up gangland's likely prospects and targets as they might horses in a form guide. It inspired little more than a ghoulish voyeurism. Was the killing of the bad really all bad? But the murder of Jason Moran on the 21st of June 2003 changed all that. Moran was known just as Jason. In the gangland ooze of nicknames, a one-name title denoted high status. Yet, despite this position and a widespread fear of the Moran limp, Mark Moran's death in June 2000 had exposed his half-brother. Carl Williams later boasted that he told Jason while they were in prison together, "I got that bullet out and had it put in your brother." By 2003, Jason Moran's warning to Williams in October 1999 loomed as a death warrant. For a time, Moran got lucky. He and Williams kept getting jailed, as if clocking on for alternating shifts. As Jason entered, Carl left, and vice versa. Soon, though, Williams was offering $200,000 for Moran's death. He and the shooter conjured odd plans, like surprising Moran by jumping out of a car boot. In another scheme, the killer was to don a wig and pretend to be a mother pushing a pram. Williams also fantasized about killing Jason at his half-brother's gravesite on the anniversary of Mark's death. They schemed for months, then botched their choice of venue. On a Saturday morning in Essendon North, surrounded by other junior footy mums and dads, Moran sat in a light blue Mitsubishi van with a friend, criminal Pasquale Little Pat Barbaro, not to be confused with a Calabrian crime boss who appears later in the book. Five kids, including Moran's six-year-old twins, sat in the back. Moran had just been diagnosed with testicular cancer. He had a gun down his pants. Let's call the killer the assassin. When he appeared at the driver's window, Moran might have glimpsed a blur of gloves and a balaclava. Then he was blasted with a shotgun and slumped forward. The assassin wasn't finished. He used a long-handled revolver to shoot Barbaro while the kids in the back looked on. Such unchecked retribution put innocence in danger. The public was glimpsing a twilight world where hitmen roamed freely and their masters plotted. Suddenly, the public mood shifted from morbid fascination to fear and anger. The citizens of the world's most livable city, as Melbourne is commonly known, demanded an end to the bloodshed. Gangland was a problem for Victoria Police, but an opportunity too. Police had faltered on organised crime in the late 1990s. Investigations had dried up, intelligence became dated, and resources were misdirected. There were several reasons for this, but the most damning was endemic police corruption. A myth of clean cops had flourished in Victoria ever since an abortion protection racket was uncovered in 1970. Senior police officers stood accused of extorting massive bribes from Collins Street medical specialists. Homicide Chief Inspector Jack Ford, the traffic branch head Superintendent Jack Matthews, and former Detective Constable Martin Jacobson were given lengthy jail terms. "By your conduct, you have severely shaken the community's confidence in the Victoria Police Force, and, inevitably, I think the morale of the force itself must have suffered," the sentencing judge told the men. The line went that the convictions meant the bad apples had been purged, yet the truth behind the shiny facade was very different. The drug squad acquired a reputation for playing by its own rules. It had lapsed into corruption in the mid-1990s, in part because of poor oversight. By the turn of the 21st century, it was another relic of the past, where the ends came to justify the means, and once fine officers slid into dark places. The drug squad's chemical diversion desk sold precursor chemicals on an undercover basis to drug suppliers, then tracked who used the chemicals to produce ecstasy and speed. The targets were big fish. Sometimes, though, detectives lost track of the chemicals they supplied. There was a relentless temptation to profit from a largely unmonitored program. This behavior remained unchecked for at least 5 years. In December 2000, someone from a chemical company contacted Victoria Police's crime department with troubling reports about the chemical diversion desk's transactions. This led to Operation Hemi. Hemi investigated allegations that drug squad members had made unauthorized purchases of chemicals and drugs of dependence from a pharmaceutical company. In July 2001, former Detective Senior Constable Stephen Payton was arrested, along with Detective Sergeant Malcolm Roseness and three civilian offenders. Payton had even set up his own chemical company in order to make the unauthorized purchases, which he later sold to criminals. He was charged with trafficking pseudoephedrine, a precursor for making speed. His supervisor, Roseness, was working as a go-between for an ecstasy supplier and an Israeli drug syndicate. He was charged with trafficking ecstasy and cocaine. On the 25th of November 1999, 6 weeks after being shot by Jason Moran, Carl Williams was roused from sleep by police inside a housing commission property in Broadmeadows. A press was punching pills in another room. Clad in a red Mambo shirt, Williams pulled the covers over his head and hid in his bed. His father George was found in a second bedroom with a loaded pistol. Police had turned up to serve arrest warrants on other people. Instead, they stumbled onto 30,000 pills and nearly 7 kilos of speed, later valued at $20 million. The drug squad was called, and Roseness and Payton turned up to investigate. The case against Williams Jr. and Sr. was delayed, on the say-so of the Supreme Court, until the charges against Roseness and Payton were heard. Both Roseness and Payton were convicted. Williams was granted bail after being held on remand for more than a year on these and subsequent drugs charges. In 2004, the 1999 charges were dropped altogether. Roseness and Payton did not corrupt this particular investigation, but they typified a cultural rot within Victoria Police. They were proof that police needed controls to avoid the temptations of human nature. Corrupt drug squad cops were motivated by the same sort of greed as gangland lords. Only the naive put good and bad at the ends of a spectrum. After Stephen Payton received a 6-year sentence, he told the Age's John Sylvester, "We were locking up crooks. You just forget where the line is." In early 2001, Christine Nixon, then a New South Wales Assistant Police Commissioner, was interviewed for the role of Victorian Chief Commissioner by a panel that included Premier Steve Brax. She told them that she doubted Victoria Police were as clean as they appeared. She would later label the drug squad's chemical diversion desk a major drug dealer. A month after Operation Hemi concluded in July 2001, Nixon instigated the so-called Purton Review, which found major problems with informer handling within the drug squad. She shut down the department in November 2001 and replaced it with the Major Drug Investigation Division, MDID. The Chemical Diversion Desk was a thing of the past. There would be random drug and alcohol tests and greater oversight of informer use, Nixon declared. But the overhaul was flawed. Old drug squad officers successfully applied to join the MDID, and some of them were dirty cops. The review also recommended that police set up a task force to continue investigating bent drug cops. The result was Operation Sehar, which ran from 2002 to 2007. Some former drug squad officers, now being implicated in crimes, were among the same officers Nicola Gobbo had been informing to a few years earlier. Detective Senior Sergeant Wayne Strawhorn, who had investigated Diamond on the strength of Gobbo's information, embodied the crossed lines. Over a decade, Strawhorn fashioned a legendary status within the drug squad. He became celebrated for bringing down high-profile drug importers. He seemed immune to material trappings. He had few obvious kinks. Then he was arrested in March 2003 and charged with supplying 2 kilos of pseudoephedrine to Mark Moran. Strawhorn was sentenced to 7 years jail after 3 trials. He had used the noble cause defense, yet his sentencing judge unambiguously declared, "Members of the police force are not above the law, and it is simply no excuse that your serious breach of the law may have resulted from some misguided belief that the end justified the means." The droppings of the former drug squad littered the gangland landscape. Bad cops meant bad men got bail and were free to go on trading drugs and shooting each other. In this environment, Gobbo was becoming known as the Bail Queen, a pro at getting suspects freed until their cases were heard. She took advantage of the growing stench of corruption that surrounded the members of the old drug squad. She was staunch in arguing that cops are corrupt, and she was a staunch defence barrister, Detective Charlie Bezina would say in 2018. Paul Dale later recounted his impressions of Gobbo during this period. When Nicola came into the St Kilda Road MDID offices, she'd seek out a sergeant because she knew that she needed to talk to people of rank. She also had contact with detectives at the Ethical Standards Department, ESD, because some of her clients had given information against corrupt police. And when the detectives from the old drug squad had corruption allegations levelled against them, Nicola Gobbo would march her clients off to bail hearings and tell the court that because of allegations of corruption, her clients might not come to trial for years. As Nixon called it, the gangland war was a turf skirmish about pill pressers and territory, about drug traffickers with hitmen on speed dial. They had a head start. None of the dozen or so gangland killings up to 2003 had been solved. In January 2003, just months before the shooting of Jason Moran changed the rules for everyone, Nixon recruited an old colleague to head up the gangland investigation. As an earnest young Australian Federal Police, AFP officer, Simon Overland had worked on the vexed investigation into the 1989 murder of AFP Assistant Commissioner Cole Winchester. Through that, he had come to know Christine Nixon of New South Wales Police. Overland felt modern, like a politician on the rise. People gravitated to him when he entered a room. He wore boots rather than brass police shoes, a choice that bolstered his already imposing height. As Assistant Commissioner Crime, Overland became the public face of Victoria Police's gangland fightback, and Nixon came to rely on him more than any other subordinate. Overland was a complex figure. One of his senior gangland investigators would tell Dowsley and Carl Lyon he found him thin-skinned and paranoid. Anyone with investigative prowess that challenged him, he would take a set against you. Carl Lyon would also interview Overland himself in 2011. Overland cited Atticus Finch and his noble pursuit of justice in To Kill a Mockingbird as an inspiration. Yet he was also prepared to win a just war using unorthodox methods. As Colonel Nathan R. Jessup said in the film A Few Good Men, the people can't handle the truth. All we, the public, had to do was stay ignorant and be grateful. At the time, homicide was broken into investigative crews, each supervised by a senior sergeant. They took turns to be on call, then were replaced by the next crew when another murder took place. The system produced independent and highly motivated crews that were able to give all their attention to individual cases. The shortcoming was that the bigger story was being missed. Each of the gangland murders was being investigated in isolation. In 2003, 3 crews realised that they had the same chief suspect for 3 separate murders. Senior Sergeant Phil Swindles, who led one of these 3 crews, began pushing for a gangland task force. Overland gave the new operation his approval. The task force, which began in May 2003, was called Rimmer to begin with, a random name thrown up by the computer. It was soon reincarnated as Purana, which refers to a class of Hindu sacred writings comprised of popular myths and legends. Hothead Benji Veniman was the starting point. At this time, Veniman was thought to have killed Dino Dibra, Paul Kalapalaitis, and Nick Radev. But building a dossier of information would take months and more deaths. Commentators have since asked whether earlier police insight into gangland might have quelled a raging war before Moore died. The success of Purana highlighted the deficiencies of earlier police models. A closed shop, Purana quickly grew to 53 staff, broken into 9 investigating groups. The task force was led by a rotation of senior officers over the course of the gangland war. Swindles headed Purana until Inspector Andrew Allen took over in August 2003. One of his replacements was Jim O'Brien, a 30-year veteran who headed Purana from 2005 to 2007. O'Brien loathed Tony Mockbell in particular. He was so proud of the task force's work that he lobbied for a Purana medal. He rotated in the role with Gavin Ryan, who led the task force's culture of modernity until 2008 as an angry enforcer of professional integrity, according to ABC journalist Chris Masters. Members of the elite squad took to wearing striped ties as a kind of uniform of excellence. Theirs was a show of camaraderie in a righteous cause, as if nodding to Elliot Ness and his untouchables. There would be no early successes, however. Nixon would describe Purana's first year as an uphill, sometimes demoralizing slog in her 2011 autobiography, Fair Cop. Purana sought to build the picture and the intelligence from the ground up, bit by bit, trying to chip away at the code of silence protecting the killers, all the while being second-guessed and undermined by commentators and even other police, Nixon wrote. And all the while, the murders continued. Police even called in Essendon football coach Kevin Sheedy for a motivational speech. The speech appeared to work. The task force became so successful that it remained active long after the 2010 death of Carl Williams, the unofficial bookend to the gangland story. Ultimately, Purana would grow to more than 100 staff, including analysts and surveillance and support crews working up to 16 hours a day. It logged 836,173 phone calls, listened on devices for 53,000 hours, and undertook 22,000 hours of physical surveillance. By the end of the war, Purana had seized more than $60 million of criminal assets. It had put Williams and Mockbell away, as well as many of the hitmen paid thousands of dollars to take a life. Purana would make names for police officers like Stuart Bateson, whose pursuit of Carl Williams was considered, favourably, as obsessive. He too would receive an Australian Police Medal. His chummy charisma underpinned his doggedness. Bateson had been earlier seconded to the Lorimer Task Force, which had successfully investigated the shooting of police officers Gary Silk and Rodney Miller in 1998. But by war's end, Purana had replaced Lorimer's task force as Victoria Police's internal benchmark of greatness. The figures on both sides of the gangland war also achieved nationwide fame when Series 1 of the Underbelly franchise, based on a book by journalists John Sylvester and Andrew Rule, premiered to popular and critical acclaim in 2008, though not seen in its entirety in Victoria till 2011 due to Supreme Court suppressions. All the major players of gangland featured in a stylized version of real events, with Bateson becoming a composite character played with charming cockiness by Roger Corsa. Crown Prosecutor Jeff Horgan, who put many of the baddies away, would call Purana the most important criminal investigation that Victoria Police produced. Nixon herself would write in her autobiography that Piranha, overseen by Simon Overland, pioneered some radical, multidimensional investigative techniques in Victoria, drawing together police intelligence, financial profiling, criminal profiling, family histories and more to build sophisticated dossiers on each of the murder victims. Yet both of them overlooked the most critical tool in Piranha's success. The history has to be rewritten. Task Force Piranha's investigation had a taint. The taint was Nicola Gobbo. By the early 2000s, Gobbo was leading the kind of double life she'd rehearsed at school. Back then, it was sex and celebrities. Now, it was guns and gangsters. Not long after Jason Moran was killed, Gobbo raised her risk-taking to a whole new level. This led to her first encounter with the Piranha Task Force. She was attracting new clients, such as Carl Williams's father, George. Soon came the celebrated Tony Mockbell bail case in 2002, which propelled Gobbo's public profile. Gobbo was a someone beyond police and crime circles, a growing fixture in the gossip and commentary pages of the Melbourne newspapers. She was becoming public property, an attention grabber for clients such as an alleged drug runner who had an iguana called Godzilla and a python called Cuddles. In a Herald Sun profile published the 8th of December 2003, entitled Million Dollar Eagle Flies High, she was described as a formidable presence in impossibly short skirts, who was fast becoming a legal celebrity. She called her father Alan her biggest influence. He was someone who always helped people and never asked for anything in return, and that's probably the biggest thing he's instilled in me. Gobbo was described by one of her siblings as a one-person salvation army. She spends time at weekends visiting clients in prison or on remand, the newspaper's John Ferguson wrote. However, she has managed to rile some of those in the police force who pay professionally when she succeeds. Gobbo told Ferguson she had friends who were police officers. "I have clients who are police. Former police who are clients," she said. "Those that are professional in what they do." It's not an antagonistic relationship at all. When she placed her beachside apartment in Middle Park on sale in October 2002, The Age reported it. In September 2002, The Sunday Age covered her trip to Bali in a gossip column story that began, "Chalk up another amazing performance by Melbourne barrister Nicola Gobbo." Nick had gone there with a girlfriend. They spent 1.2 million rupiahs shouting beers for American sailors at their hotel bar. "It was a long night," a source said. There's a strong chance the source was Gobbo herself. A few months later, in the lead-up to the November 2002 Victorian state election, a debate was held between the major candidates, Robert Doyle and Steve Brax. It prompted The Age to seek expert responses from 3AW's Neil Mitchell, the ABC's Virginia Trioli, a political scientist, and barrister Nicola Gobbo. It gave Victorians an opportunity to decide whether to trust a Liberal Party leader who offers no original thought and whose answers were evasive and lacking in substance, Labor supporter Gobbo declared. The bail queen was becoming a celebrity, just like the gangland clients she represented, and the higher the death toll climbed, the more their status rose. Then Gobbo was asked to appear for Mockbell and Williams's rival, Lewis Moran, at a bail application over drug trafficking charges. It was July 2003, a month after Jason Moran's execution at a kids' football clinic. Mockbell and Williams ordered her not to accept the job. Yet she did appear on Moran's behalf, successfully. In court, Gobbo argued that the children of murdered half-brothers Mark and Jason Moran needed a father figure. Police protested that Lewis Moran, if freed, might try to avenge Jason's and Mark's killings. But Moran got bail. Later the same week, Gobbo received a visit from Benji Venuman. He was there to menace her, at Williams's behest, for assisting an enemy player. He screamed and threatened me, she later said in a sworn affidavit. You are part of our crew. You were told not to go anywhere near Moran, and you did it anyway. How dare you do what we told you not to do? Tony's not happy with you. Carl is not happy with you. You're a fucking dog. Yet Gobbo was not to be put off. She was never someone to bow to unreasonable threats. She would willingly place herself in danger, as if confident that forces beyond her control would save her when required. She appeared again for Moran the following week. Afterwards, she was approached by Swindles on the Melbourne Magistrates Court steps, a backdrop for many unscheduled meetings between police officers and Gobbo. The pair chatted amid criminals, belligerents, media photographers, and police officers. The Piranha Task Force had been launched just a few months earlier. Police intelligence had picked up the threat against Gobbo. Swindles told Gobbo to be careful because Veniman was a dangerous individual. The chat with Swindles led to talks with Bateson, one of his officers at the time. She was already acquainted with Bateson through representing suspects in the Jason Moran hit, and she and Bateson would work closely in getting convictions in events described in the following chapters. Gobbo was still 2 years away from being registered again as a police informer. But she was soon informing anyway, to Bateson. She had been a lawyer for 6 years, and she had been informing both on and off the books for 6 years. The triggers for her duplicities ahead seem obvious enough. No one forgets a hitman like Veniman outside their home. But her loyalties were professionally mandated. She was selling out her own side in a choice no other lawyer would contemplate. She rang Bateson repeatedly and met him for coffee at the Emerald Hotel to feed him secrets about her clients. She threw in legal colleagues too for purportedly helping Williams and other gangland heavyweights avoid prosecution. She accused these peers of perverting the course of justice, bowing to the demands of their kingpin clients by protecting them at the expense of their underlings. It seems unfair to name these lawyer targets, given they were never charged, but they commanded similar profiles to Gobbo's at the time. Bateson, rightly, suspected Gobbo herself of similar misconduct. He manipulated her to glean information, she would claim in 2019, but he was more professional, or gentlemanly, than Strawhorn. We did start off, when I say start off, when I first had dealings with Stuart, he made it clear that he didn't trust me, didn't approve of me, she said. He specifically told me that I was having a sexual relationship with Carl Williams, which was ridiculous and absurd. I wouldn't say Bateson was a fan of mine at the beginning. Gobbo has had many years to contemplate this relationship, as she has the relationships with Strawhorn and other police handlers, official or otherwise. I can look back now with hindsight, a wonderful thing as it is, and, like, what possessed me to have all of those conversations with him, and why did I feel the need to basically purge my soul to someone who claimed that he did but didn't have my interests at heart, she wondered. Meanwhile, gangland machinations rumbled, keeping Gobbo and other lawyers busy. Willie Thompson, a drug dealer and gym junkie, was officially listed as a lollipop vendor. In reality, he was linked to the Morans and Nick Radov. He was killed in his convertible on the 21st of July 2003, a month after Jason Moran. The hit, outside his southeast Melbourne gym, was a messy job, with bullets lodging in nearby buildings. It was a clue to the rising recklessness. Thompson, a school friend of Tony Mockbell, was thought to have been killed on the orders of Williams over a drug trade dispute. In a subsequent catch-up at Red Rooster, it was believed that Mockbell asked Williams to kill Thompson's killer. Williams brokered a deal to kill his nominated patsy for the Thompson hit, Michael Marshall, officially a hot dog vendor, but likely a drug dealer. Williams deployed his hitmen on the 25th of October. Marshall's shooter would later claim that he didn't see Marshall's 5-year-old as he pumped 4 or 5 bullets into the father's head. "Someone shot Daddy," the boy cried, running inside to his mother. In gangland, one death begat the next. A piranha cop chatted with a gangland figure, purportedly asking him to stop leaving bodies in the street. The charred remains of the next gangland victim, Mark Malia, were found in a wheelie bin stuffed down a drain on the 18th of August 2003. He was killed on the orders of Williams. Malia had worked for Radev before Radev was killed. One theory behind his murder goes that he had rattled Williams by asking questions about Radev's death at a seafood lunch at Crown Casino. Williams decided that Malia had to die. Malia was tortured with a soldering iron in a garage before being killed. Even some of the giants were starting to feel threatened. In early 2004, Mick Gatto brokered a flimsy truce with Williams after Gatto's mate Graham Kinneborough was gunned down in his Kew driveway after midnight on the 13th of December 2003. Gatto assumed that Williams had ordered Kinneborough's death and had heard of a contract on his own head. Their exchange was caught on a Crown Casino security video, and experts deciphered the chat. "If anything comes my way, then I'll send somebody to you," Gatto told Williams. "I'll be careful with you. Be careful with me. I believe you. You believe me. Now we're even. That's a warning. It's not my war." Ironically, though, it was Gatto who inadvertently made the war's next move. The shooting of hitman Benji Venuman at a Carlton restaurant on the 23rd of March relieved everyone who feared the little hitman, including Gobbo. According to Gatto's version, Venuman pulled the gun on him. Then Gatto tried to wrestle the gun from Venuman's hand. During the struggle for control of the gun, 5 shots were fired. 3 bullets hit Venuman, 1 in his head and 2 through his neck. Gatto's account was accepted in a jury finding of self-defense. Yet Gatto was haunted by memories of the gurgling and the splatter. He was no Macbeth, but he later had a Banquo-esque moment, which he recounted in his 2010 book. He woke one night choking, convinced that a ghostly Venuman had returned to throttle him. Police had already linked Benji to the murders of Dino Dibra, Paul Kalapolitis, and Nick Radev, but they would eventually suspect he also killed Frank Benvenuto, Victor Pierce, Graham Kinneborough, and Mark Malia. He was dead before police could charge him with a single murder. As Benji Venuman expired inside a Carlton pizzeria, Gobbo was still 18 months away from being re-registered as a police informer. But her perplexing place in events leading up to the tragic double murder of Terry and Christine Hodson revealed she was already as big a liar as any gangland hitman. The Hodson murders proved just how out of her depth she was.